Tate Chronicles now transmitting.
Welcome to the Tate Chronicles on Healthcare Now Radio. And now, here's your host, Jim Tate.
Good day, citizens of the free world. From border to border, coast to coast, and to all the ships at sea, I bring you a warm welcome. This is your correspondent, Jim Tate, and thank you for tuning in to the Tate Chronicles. Join me as we cut through the fog that exists at the leading edge of healthcare technology. I'm really pleased today. My guest is Paul Wilder. Paul is the executive director of the Commonwealth Health Alliance. Most of you folks have heard of the Commonwealth Alliance. It's a not-for-profit trade association, which really is focused to the simple vision that health data should be available to individuals and caregivers, regardless of where that care may occur. Additionally, an important factor for Commonwealth is that access to this data really needs to be built into health IT at a reasonable cost so it can be used by a broad range of healthcare providers and the people they serve. Paul, welcome to the Tate Chronicles.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you, Jim.
I'm really looking forward to talking to you today. First, I'm always curious how folks find themselves involved in health IT. Can you tell us your journey, how you got involved with health IT?
Yeah, I'll try and make it brief. It's not my forte, but I've been in health IT in some way, shape, or form for about two decades and change, starting out radiology, cardiology. But somewhere in the middle of that, I got involved with meaningful use and the regional extension centers, helping primary care providers adopt EHR technology. And attached to that company I worked with was HIE stuff. And the reason why I came over to that company was I had an experience with my daughter when, you know, she was first born, where we moved her from the hospital to home, minor issue in like her third day of life, brought her to the pediatrician, went back to another hospital. And amazingly, none of her data flowed. I mean, zero. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about a distance of a crow's flight distance of maybe 3 miles, right, across the Hudson River. Like I could practically see the hospital. And it was kind of embarrassing, right? We're in this, you know, fantastic, great land with great resources. And the answer for why they couldn't get the records was the chart record was between floors. Literally, it was on paper, sitting in a file folder on a cart, going down to medical records, and no one knew which card it was on or where to get it. And I was like, this is ridiculous. And I later on had my dad diagnosed with cancer, and he had to collect all of his records. And this was only, you know, 3 years ago. So we're not done. We're better because they hit buttons to print out his records as opposed to having to go find that cart. But the reality is we've done a lot of work. We need a little bit more to do. And quite frankly, I think we're getting there. Like we're starting to hit the, you know, from an adoption curve, getting to the laggards, those last people that we have to convert and get them to understand their better way. So I'm excited to be here and happy to be able to, you know, shape the future where we go.
You know, one thing that you mentioned, Paul, is the HIEs, those health information exchanges. For a while, they were more or less called RIOs, Regional Health Information Organizations, I believe. And that, I guess, was a necessary stepping stone. But in effect, those were also silos. Because if you were in Georgia and had moved to Mississippi, those organizations didn't exchange data. And so it was better, but we weren't all the way there. I guess that was some of the driving force behind the birth of the Commonwealth Alliance was to come up with some type of transcendental, for lack of a better word, technology and culture that was maybe organizational and geographically agnostic. Am I right about any of that, Paul?
That's right. I think you hit on it in the introduction. You mentioned at a good enough price, right? So not expensive. And you have to distribute the benefits and the pain a little bit. So HIEs were very siloed, state and regional. And when Commo first got birthed, people were like, oh no, is this competitive to the HIEs? And I think I said back then, I still believe it. No, I think the HIEs serve a different purpose now than they even thought they served in the beginning, which is serving kind of the state and local regional needs that, quite frankly, we're not going to solve for, right? There's too many public health departments, immunization registries, and various registries at a local level for Commo to be able to deal with. But what we do deal with very well is creating scale at a very affordable price. And the scale comes from having, you know, fierce competitors agreeing to solve this problem of getting interoperability to work. And the difference is it spreads out a little bit of the pain, like so, and it's a benefit to the user. It's embedded in the product, which means that our members, this is Cerner, eClinicalWorks, et cetera, need to think about how to design the thing such that a user can see benefit, that it's seamless, and they can support it, as opposed to what the HIEs tendency have is automation, a lot of people trying to make that automation work. So it's just not as scalable. You know, I have myself and one employee and a very good service provider behind me, but that's it. I'm going to be hiring two more people in the next year, but we're still very, very small because we have great partners making sure this stuff works at scale without having to be centrally scaled at the core. We're not a silo. We're conduits to a bunch of other sources of data.
Sure. And so you mentioned partners. Are these healthcare vendor entities? Are these healthcare provider organizations? Who are your partners?
Well, they are the partners, right? So they're members too. But to come together into this membership, and I talk to new members all the time, and they talk about whether they would be a partner to Commonwealth. I said, look, every member is a partner, right? There's no, and I prefer not that secret special sauce with one versus another. The idea is to have a uniform platform specification and standard way of interoperating such that we can all rely on the technology and then they can differentiate from there. So when new members come up and start asking, well, I have an RFP, I have an RFI, I say, well, you know, sometimes I wish I was at that scale where I could start doing custom stuff. But the reality is I even have to bang myself down sometimes and go, you know, the objective here is to make it seamless, easy, and inexpensive so we can continue growing at scale. We're at 1 billion documents a year being exchanged. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, Jim, those 1 billion documents, that rate, the last 1 billion was in the last year. Up until then, we did 0.6. It took us 7 years to get to 1.6 billion. And that last 1 billion happened in the last 12 months. So the scale keeps going up. And to be able to get to that scale, we need to have some level of uniformity and standardize across the way things work. So everybody's a partner, yes, but everybody's also a partner in making sure every other partner agrees to work the same way so they can scale and continue to grow with ease for the sake of the benefit of the patients as well as providers.
One thing you mentioned there, Paul, is an agreement of how things work. And so we know that CMS and Office of National Coordinator and different work groups have standardized various coding systems around diagnoses and medications, around such types of interoperability files as CCDA and FHIR, and we'll get into FHIR in a minute. And so those are kind of the technical things. But then how does Commonwealth work maybe to help support that next step of the culture that, you know, many providers who practice now are not used to using outside data? So if you could speak to that.
Yeah, well, first of all, we do use a lot of the standards that were established many moons ago. If you look at our specification, and if you're not, you know, a super geeky technical person, I wouldn't recommend that unless you really want to, you know, fall asleep at the beach with a nice umbrella. But it's a little bit dense. But the reality is we added to the IHE, the Integrating the Healthcare Enterprise standards that were formed under, in the US, at scale under Healthy Way and NWHIN, and later on Sequoia and others, took those and said, what's missing? And what was really missing was a way to link patients in a way that was safe, secure, kept the patient at the center, but distributed the matching logic across the entire enterprise. Really, Commonwealth is a set of members that all have their own enterprises, right? So each of those vendors has a series of customers, but they've all opted into this other club, this other enterprise, which shares across everything. And so the standards we had to add were about how to manage those patients. Now, if you look at the way HIEs tend to work, they tend to work with setting an algorithm to do that. And we did things differently. There's a base algorithm that gives some hints as to where to find patients. But we really do rely on the workflow in the EHR product to finish the job, to help select the patient, to match them safely, to delink them if they want to be out of the network, et cetera. So it distributes the consent, privacy, security, and it requires members to convince their customers and explain why this is better than not having this data. And I think they do that first and foremost by having the technology that supports it. So you take medication reconciliation, make sure it's easy, make sure it does some prefetching so they can do what they need to do without it being a burden. put it in the product, make it part of the DNA of the product and the care cycle, not something on the side extra in a web viewer or that disjoints the workflow and creates more time and headache for providers and the administrators alike.
One of the things that you mentioned, Paul, that I certainly have heard about as a pain point over the years is patient matching. I've got all this data, but how do I know it belongs to the same patient? And I know there's some federal legislation, I guess it's still in place, that says Social Security numbers cannot be used for patient matching. And so what are some of the challenges and workarounds for patient matching?
Yeah, the most common thing used for patient matching across healthcare in the United States is a person's name, their birth date, gender, and then address information, sometimes phone numbers and other kind of rudimentary demographics. And the reality is some of them are more specific than others. You know, there's probably a lot of John Smiths with the same birth date around the country. The likelihood of a John Smith with the same birth date with the same exact address in their recent history, not very high.
Right.
The problem is a lot of that address information was historically not entered extremely accurately. You know, it's improved a lot. And what's improved that is bringing the data, the demographic data, not even talking clinical data to the patient, right? So we have more kiosks and portals. And so I can see when things are wrong. I remember typing in a kiosk, my email address, and it put .con as in Nancy instead of .com as in Mary. And I was like, oh, this, I'm never going to get portal access. I'm never going to get a tickler reminder. I can't reset my password. Can you please fix that? What's interesting is it was incredibly hard to do. You know, the person at that desk did not know how to do it. And the only solution was for me to recreate my record. So we still have a couple of things we need to do to make it a little bit easier, because there are some things we say you cannot correct because they're fundamental to the record. And sometimes the only way to fix is to make a new record and merge the stuff. But the reality is we are doing better at it. So we're able to better match, but there's a lot of historical data. So the way Commonwealth worked for years was to present near matches to the user for them to select the person that is the same Paul Wilder. What we've done recently is add scrubbing or cleanup technology to clean up addresses to make them more normalized so we can use them. The specificity of first name, last name, date of birth, city, state, zip code, first line of your address, you add all that together, you have like a 54 character string.
Yes.
Pretty specific, even more so than a social security number is. But we don't often know our own addresses. It's a weird thing. Like I could type my address condo 2, when actually my town calls it apartment 2, and they call it APT 2 very specifically. So you need to normalize that stuff so we can do the matching, because computers don't guess that well unless you program them. And it's hard to program all the exceptions. So it's better to normalize it from the get-go and get it right.
You know, one thing I've seen in terms of matching, that's a little bit related to this type of thing as far as offering alternative matches, I guess. Some of the genealogical websites, you're doing some research, and they'll bring up a bunch of hints and say, this person may be the person you're doing research on. And they'll have the date of birth or something like that. And you could either say yes or no or maybe, that kind of stuff. So let's hop over to a totally different subject, fire. We've been hearing about fire, F-H-I-R, for a number of years. It almost seems like every year this is the year that fire is going to bring great value. Give us a little background on fire and where we are with that and why fire matters to interoperability.
Well, yeah, it has been a buzzword for a long time. I can go back, over half a decade ago, talking about when are we going to have, fire at the edge of our HIE, or at least at the other side, accepting data via fire. And the reality is it wasn't initially designed for that kind of scale, the stuff we do at Commonwealth. It was really a good point-to-point technology. And we used fire from the beginning for some of the kind of point-to-point-ish stuff, RESTful interfaces to do person management. We mentioned this linking stuff. Those were actually leveraged off of FHIR technologies. We added FHIR Document Exchange a couple of years after that and been doing that for many years now. But when people think of FHIR, they don't think of documents. They're really thinking of discrete data exchange. And we think it is, it's really, truly, finally on the cusp of adoption. And, you know, we know what's going to happen first. We see the regulatory environment is pushing towards FHIR disclosure of data to patients in, you know, kind of authorized or certified consumer applications. And I think that's great. I really do think shortly after that, you're going to see that move to payers and providers using the same technology. And for lack of a robust discussion, it's just that it's a little more efficient, right? The services under FHIR versus the way we do things CommWell today are a little lighter, allow for more transactional access to rudimentary data like meds, diagnosis, procedures, and things like that. Mm-hmm. What we need to do better on is getting better standards. And they do exist in FHIR R4, by the way, is the clinical exam notes. Because if you talk to providers, it's interesting. There's like two camps out there. There are people that really like the discrete data and being able to reconcile stuff and have interoperability that way. And then there's those that from a physician to care want to hear what other doctors had to say, the discharge summary,
yes,
like the clinical notes that came from another provider.
Yes.
And so we focused a long time on that discrete data stuff because let's face it, EHR people think like HIT, which has IT, which thinks of ones and zeros, which thinks of discrete data first. And we're only now realizing there's a lot of providers that really want that verbose stuff. It's not really about NLP and natural language processing and making codes out of it. It's presenting the actual thing that the doctor said along with that discrete data set. So I think we're finally there realizing it's not one or the other, it's both. And if you do both, you can really advance what we do in healthcare tremendously. Because document exchange is great. It's a little bit too voluminous in many cases to get through and sift through. But if you can get just that key discrete data and get just those key clinical notes and the rest is there for, you know, quality improvement and care coordination, all the things that computers can do, you know, even better, right? So I really think it's going to jumpstart things in a way we have not seen probably late 23, if I were to take a pretty good guess.
You know, that whole issue of clinical notes, that really is, in a lot of ways, the patient's story. And that's where we would find out, you know, with discrete data, maybe somebody has, they've gone to infectious disease specialists and they've been diagnosed with some type of infectious response. But in the clinical notes would be the story that they have been going to a certain gym in town for a month. And those kind of connections can start being that are not discrete, but can be part of diagnosis and treatment protocols.
Yeah, also it helps with medications. You know, you'll see in those stories, they could explain pushed X because of Y, mm-hmm, found a result that they have a reaction to it. But in that, you'll find out if it's a severe reaction or near or not. Right? That's where you're going to. So you'll look in the record and you'll see allergy to X medication, and you might see a severity. But when you hear from the doctor and kind of understand, I understand I shouldn't use this because the person's allergic. But if this is, if they have a condition that absolutely is the only thing I know of to do, it's the only thing I have available, do I have a safe way of using it temporarily to get them back on course? And the notes may say that. They saw a mild reaction to whatever, then stabilized by pushing whatever until they could get XYZ equipment to stabilize further. You need that story sometimes to understand when to do things that the data says you're not supposed to do. Right, because you know, and medicine is an art and a science, and sometimes art isn't about coloring by numbers.
Right,
it's about imagination and understanding how things work when you put it all together, light and everything. So I think it is more than just that data to really serve the patient as best as we can, and providers too. So I'm excited to see that change.
Yeah, Paul, I really appreciate you underscoring that. I think that's really important. Now, a little birdie told me that CommWell just had your fall summit. Can you give us some recaps? Where was that? How'd it go? What's going on?
Yeah, so the Fall Summit, we didn't have it in person last year, which is, we have one every year. The Fall Summit is an all-member event. So it's not like a public conference. You won't see a registration like somewhere to attend next year. It is for our members, but anybody can be a member. So be a member, come to the conference. And there we kind of go over, we start out with where we were, why we were there, where we want to go, and then have a dialogue about kind of what's next. And a little bit of occasional nudging on trying to improve like new use cases and things like that. So we had a great conversation on the growth, how we've handled it, how it's actually going pretty well. But of course, we can always, you know, use improvement to be able to get there. There's TEFCA coming up, which is a huge, huge thing for us as kind of the model QIN, Qualified Health Information Network, to be under TEFCA. You know, we want to make sure that everybody understands what's going on there. talked a lot about fire and then adoption of new use cases, in particular, kind of hammering home a bit on how to get patient access to work and, quite frankly, how to get patient access within TEFCA with the next set of extended partners that we're likely to have, how we want to double down on solving that problem versus, you know, letting it lay where it is. I don't think we're doing that the way we should be for patient access in systems like ours. And there's a lot of stuff going on ONC for fire I like, and that does help. But I'd hate to see these large national networks come together, converge things, and still not be able to engage patients with their data. Because I think patients are the ultimate data quality adjudicator, because I'm the most interested in my data over everybody else. So I'd like to make sure they have access and they can then manage their care and everything else they need to do.
And for our listeners who are not sure what TEFCA is, it's the Trusted Exchange Framework and Common Agreement. And so we certainly have initiatives from the private sector. We have certainly initiatives from the federal government, all trying to move the needle on interoperability. Where do you think improvements still need to be made?
Well, we hit on it before. And the main one is I think we need a better dialogue and solutions being presented on how to safely match patients. We've been doing a pretty good job within Commonwealth. We, even at the summit, we talked about this, how we don't see our patient matching logic as intellectual property. We'd love everybody to understand what we're doing, help us improve ours and bring theirs up too. Because right now we have, you know, you make a query, this is not in Commonwealth, this is normal interoperability amongst everything else outside of Commonwealth. Between two sites, they send a packet of demographics and the other side says yes or no. And there's some problems with the T in TEFCA, the trust, that's that first word. If you don't know what the other side is doing with that data, right? Did they not give me data because the patient didn't match or because the patient wasn't there? Is their algorithm stricter or not? To allow providers to rely, I think that's a really important word, to rely on the systems to get data. They need to know they're getting all of it, and if not, get the right errors to understand what they need to fix to get it. Otherwise, it's going to be secondary data forever, right? What if I'm pretty sure this person has data in Cleveland Clinic or in, you know, UCSF. If it doesn't come back for them, I'm confused. And now I'm worried about what this data source is doing for me. It's like, this patient just told me they were there. Yeah. Why isn't the data coming back? Mm-hmm. And the thing that stops that the most is patient data not matching. And the problem is we don't know if it's the sender side not giving the right demographics to make the responder respond correctly or if their algorithm is messed up. So I do think we need a conversation on a unified, acceptable, safe algorithm that does a good enough job at scale to match patients so that then when things don't work, we know exactly what to fix as opposed to guessing.
You know, we've talked certainly a lot about the technical aspects and so-called plumbing of interoperability. What about the cultural aspects where the process or just the way entities or providers practice healthcare, they start reaching out more or they're open or the exchange of data becomes more day-to-day than it was 10 years ago? Where are we?
Well, the culture of data as a general term, right, is data is power, right? Data is, it can be monetized. And I think the culture has shifted in healthcare to data is necessary. And everybody realizes that the data they have is important to the next step and the other person's data is important to their step. And you know, I call it, it's a data potluck, right? You have to bring data to get data. And before, I think that was the exchange. That was the idea to get people moving is, you know, we'll get you all this data from these 25,000 sites as long as you bring yours to the table. And I think it shifted where I don't have to explain that to most people, right? I explained that as the mechanism of the trust framework, just to say, yeah, this is how we've set it up. But we don't have to go through that. No one talks about having data and not sharing it. They just ask, how do they do it, right? So that's different.
Yes, it
is. Yeah, it's very different. I think the reliance, though, I think that patient matching and data quality needs to go up so that people can rely on it as being a near or fully complete record to do their job. Otherwise, they'll continue to use the secondary workflows as their primary workflow. And secondary meaning picking up the phone, faxing, emailing, sure, direct messages. I'm not saying those won't be used. In fact, I think a lot of the data we exchange should lead to those conversations, right? You know, I've read your clinical notes. I have the data here. Just one question I don't quite understand. Can you help me with? So I think we need to get to there where it's reliable enough that it's always the workflow So that providers use it even more. And then you'll see, just add a zero to the number of documents exchanged every week. It's going to go nuts.
Paul, it's hard to believe, but our time has almost gotten away from us here. But before we sign off, I want to remind our listeners they can find out more about Commonwealth and the work Commonwealth's doing and the mission at commonwealthalliance.org. That's commonwealthalliance.org. To our audience, thanks for joining me on this episode of the Tate Chronicles. I offer a special salute to my guest today, Paul Wilder of the Commonwealth Health Alliance. Paul, thanks for coming aboard today.
Oh, thank you. I look forward to follow-ups and people visiting the website and contacting us. I'd love to keep the conversation going.
You can find more information on this show's program page at healthcarenowradio.com. Until we meet again, here's wishing you smooth sailing and safe harbors.
Tate Chronicles transmission ending now.